When we have a health problem, some of us head straight to the doctor and follow their advice, to the letter. Others, though, prefer to look for solutions elsewhere, like searching online or relying on what seems to have worked for friends or family with similar symptoms. With so much information available at our fingertips these days, it can be hard to figure out what's best for your health. If this is something you grapple with, tell us where you go to for health advice. Pop a post on our Facebook page or send me a text. The text number is 0418 226 576. Dr. Rod Lamberts is with us. He's Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science at the ANU. He'll help us understand how to interpret health science. Rod, welcome to Life Matters.
Hey, how are you going, Hillary?
Good. What should we be looking for when we come across a new study or a research paper to see if it's reliable and evidence-based?
Well, I hope you got your pen and paper out. I could rattle you off a very long list.
Oh, yeah, I'm taking notes.
What should you look for? I mean, look, the really simple, straightforward stuff first is, of course, who's allegedly the author of it, who's being credited as the author of the work or the institution that put forward the work or the study or the result. That at least gives you some indication of whether they're at least qualified to be able to say anything about that kind of area at all. I think if it's in a news outlet, you should consider the news outlet itself. Do they have vested or considered interests? Do they have a particular political leaning? Do they have an interest in presenting one side of a case or another? I think that can matter a lot, especially at the moment. There's also things like, you know, is it a very recent study? Is the language over the top? Because, I mean, I think anyone who's anywhere near the media knows as soon as you see the word breakthrough, you should be suspicious. It's cheap journalism, so to speak. So if you see breakthrough and overstuffed claims, very excited language, perhaps be suspicious first. What else? Do you want to ask me anything in particular, or do you want me to just keep rattling them off?
Right, let's go through a few of the things that I guess crop up a lot for people when they're wondering what they can trust. How many studies do you need to see replicating the same results before you go, okay, that's reliable?
How long's a piece of string? Look, I suppose a very rough rule of thumb, more is better, but I mean, a whole bunch of terrible studies does not make up for one good one. So it's not necessarily that straightforward. If this is a provisional result or if it's a brand new result and no one else has checked it, then yes, approach it perhaps with optimism but skepticism. So wait and see. But if this is something, if you're looking at a proposed cure for COVID or something like this, if it's been repeatedly tested over time across different places by different people under different circumstances, you can start to feel at least a little more confident. So, you know, numbers matter, but they're not the be-all and end-all.
What about the numbers of the sample size, say, that was tested? How important are they?
Look, that can be important, but again, it depends on what you're testing. So if you just rely on a large sample size, one of the downsides of a large sample size with some statistics is you can get what you would call a significant result very easily because the numbers are so huge. So the procedures allow for that. Whereas a very small sample size may, if it gets a result, could suggest that that's quite a strong result. That said, it's probably more important to consider whether it's even possible to get a large sample size, depending on what you're looking at. I mean, if it's a particular condition that only a few people have, you can't test 100,000 people because there aren't 100,000 people with it. So medicine gets trickier that way.
What about where the study is published? Do you have to look for a reputable journal, or is a self-published study potentially also going to be a good evidence standard?
Again, as a rule of thumb, if it's published in a reputable journal, which shouldn't be too hard to tell, that's a better indicator that it's at least been more rigorously considered by people who are experts. Self-publication, that's down the more perilous end. So it may be that there's some good work done under self-publication. It may be terrible. It could be tricky to tell. One of the things people who write sort of faker stuff or more dodgy stuff will do is they will provide lots and lots and lots and lots of links within their studies. And so you in a sense get this overwhelming tide of information, or what appears to be information. It makes it look like they've done a lot of research when they may not have, or the subject matter of the references could be absolute garbage, but the sheer weight of the numbers can be quite persuasive. So as a rule, look for where the journal's been, where the article's been published, what the journal is. That helps. That's as good an indicator as often you can get if you're only looking at a short press release. Then that's, of course, depending on whether you can even read the journal access it. You might not be able to tell how good that journal is. You might not be able to read the paper itself, there's a lot of complexities around this, or little nuances that aren't always available to everyone.
And I think that's one of the issues that come up for people, that they feel a bit excluded from how science works. Mm. I do want to touch on peer review, though, because that's something that does happen in reputable journals. How important is that in assessing the reliability of a study?
But peer reviews, it's a critical part of the process, and has been for quite a long time now. And the purpose of it is to have at least a couple of people who are expert in the realm that's been studied, but who aren't interested, who don't have a potential conflict of interest with the study itself. So they can review it technically, but they don't have a personal or financial or reputational interest. So that's important. That said, of course, it's not perfect. Peers are still people. They may have their own interests, their own blind spots, their own biases as well. So it's not, you know, an absolute bulletproof system, but it's one of the best ones we have when conducted appropriately. It's very useful.
When you talk about vested interest too, Rod, a question that comes up for a lot of people is funding. How important is who funds the work to the actual lab work that researchers do? How much of an effect does it have?
Look, it can vary a lot. It's obviously the thing to be most cynical about is, you know, a report on, you know, the effects of smoking on lungs conducted by, you know, Philip Morris or something. Of course, you're going to be suspicious.
Conducted, though, as opposed to funded by.
Oh, sorry, funded. Yeah, well, either, really. And sometimes there might be a fine line between the two. But funding can matter. Funding, even funding that has the best of intentions, may have particular restrictions. It may be an organization may fund research that only covers certain areas or is only interested in looking down certain avenues. So it may be with the best of intentions they've conducted research that isn't quite as useful as it could be. That's not a guarantee, but it's worth looking into. So again, yeah, look at the funding bodies, and in real legitimate sort of academic and institutional research, funding bodies will be disclosed within organisations, within publications and so forth. So it shouldn't be too hard to hunt down and see if there may be vested interest. It may not be obvious what that vested interest is, though.
We're often told that the best way to test evidence in a clinical trial is a double-blind, randomised control test. Can you tell us what that is and why it's the best way?
Yeah, the gold stamp there is because the people who are participants in the study assigned literally at random to whether they're getting a treatment or they're not getting a treatment, a control group or an experimental group, for example. So there's no systematic way the researchers decide who goes where. So that's one step of it being potentially more likely to be even-handed and non-biased. But then the people who are doing the experiment then don't know whether they're handing over a placebo drug, for example, or the actual drug that's being tested. So in a sense, they're blind to what's going on within the experiment as well. So then their own biases, even if they're implicit, won't necessarily come sneaking through. So people who are assigned randomly, the people actually conducting the research don't know whether they're handling an actual compound or whether they're handling a control group or a placebo drug. So in theory, you're eliminating a lot of the potential bias that may come into the conduct of the experiment.
We've had a question via text about positive results. Are they more likely to get published than negative results?
As a rule, yeah. It's a big argument in academia and amongst journals a lot, because publishing results where someone had a hypothesis that didn't work is very uncommon. And part of that is because, or a big part of that is the practicalities of this. There are so many people doing so much different research that to physically somehow publish all this stuff would be extremely difficult. So it is more common to see a positive result by far, yeah. That doesn't necessarily mean it's dubious, though. It's just that negative results, there are so many of them, and it's hard to give them somewhere to be published. Trying to find peer reviewers is difficult, as you asked about that a moment ago. Peer reviewers do it for free. They do it in their own time. The people who are more likely to say yes are more likely to get asked to do it more often. So you get a smaller and smaller pool of people in some disciplines being relied on to review studies. So all these practicalities get in the way of publishing negative results or non-results.
There's a real picture emerging of science as a collaborative and quite a slow and a enterprise, but also one filled with goodwill, that all these people working together towards a result that might be a long time down the track. We'll talk in a little while about how different that is from the modern media landscape with you, Rod Lamberts, Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science at ANU. But I want to also bring in Leanne Wells. She's the CEO of the Consumers Health Forum, Australia's leading advocate on consumer healthcare issues. Leanne, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Hilary.
Now, Leanne, is there anything wrong with us doing our own research when it comes to health advice rather than just trusting what our doctor says?
Look, I don't think there is anything wrong with patients doing their own research. You know, I think we always say that informed patients and informed decision making gets a better health outcome. I think the key thing for people to understand is, you know, how do you equip yourself with the right information at the right time to make good decisions, you know, and, you know, just endorsing Rod's comments there, I think what people need to be really mindful of is, you know, spurious or dubious claims, you know, celebrity endorsements. They're the sort of things, you know, we really need to have our radar out for. And, you know, I think by all means, Dr. Google, there's really good websites that people can go to now that aren't necessarily, you know, conversations they're going to be having direct with a doctor, of course, which is really important. And we know from our research that GPs and pharmacists are well-trusted sources of advice for people. But, you know, back to Rod's point about going to the experts, organisations, you know, not-for-profit organisations like the Cancer Council, like Arthritis and Asthma Australia, those sorts of organisations work with clinicians closely to provide support and information to people. So it's not a bad thing to be informing and equipping yourself with information. It's about the right information and where do you go to get that.
Leanne, it was interesting talking to Hamish McDonald on Brekkie earlier, and he was saying he doesn't see one doctor anymore. He doesn't have a relationship unless he goes back home to his hometown with a particular family doctor. And that's the case for a lot of people. Wondering if that is fueling or part of a shift away in Australia from people relying on traditional methods of getting health advice to more informal methods. Would you say that's something you've seen or not?
Look, I think it's a trend. We're a mobile population. We like convenience, and we've certainly seen with COVID, you know, the COVID response has seen the introduction of telehealth services and a dramatic acceleration of those kinds of services that weren't previously funded under Medicare. So there's a real balancing point, I think. You know, for some people with straightforward issues, they're not bad. They're convenient. You can access healthcare quickly. I think where it becomes more of a concern is when we're talking about people with, you know, lots of multimorbidities, lots of, you know, co-occurring complex conditions. And that's pretty commonplace these days, particularly with our older population. And that's where, you know, all the evidence is, and we're strong proponents of this, that, you know, an ongoing, continual relationship with a GP and a wider primary care team is really important, because that's where a lot of quality and safety issues can play out for patients when their care becomes disconnected. That's where we need to have the sort of alert radar flag up.
We'd love to hear where you go for your health advice. Head to our Facebook page and pop a post up on there. Or you can send me a text right now. We'd love to hear why you chose that particular avenue to find your health information. 0418 226 576 here on Life Matters. Leanne Wells is the CEO of the Consumers Health Forum, and she's with us with Dr. Rod Lamberts, Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science. Leanne, has the coronavirus changed our levels of trust in our medical professionals, do you think?
That's an interesting question, Hilary. Look, reflecting on that, I think it has. And I think when you think about the coronavirus, it was such a shock, wasn't it, to the community, to the economy. It just reverberated. And I think in the early days of our lockdown, you know, the anxiety and the fearfulness in the community, you know, was palpable. So I think in circumstances like that, which are unprecedented for us, really, this sort of public health crisis, people do turn to and want authoritative, factual, trustworthy information. So I think, you know, what we've seen is an enormous amount of public trust in, you know, the deputy chief health officers and the chief health officer, and, you know, and authorities. I mean, notwithstanding Rod's point earlier about media, but, you know, Norman Swan's coronavirus program, for example, you know, they are perceived as very trustworthy sources. And it's just so important that the public does respond that way and look and act to information from those sources in a crisis like this, because it's actually, as we keep getting told the way we behave as a community with respect to hygiene and social distancing and our compliance with that, that is, you know, one of the biggest factors to combating the virus over time.
Just before we talk a little further about public perceptions and how we shift them, Leanne, I wanted to ask you about health support groups. How do you make sure that they don't have particular biases operating? Because they're there for really the most vulnerable people in vulnerable situations, aren't they?
They are. And look, I think it's similar principles to the ones Rod was describing, really. Look at their funding, look at the experts that they work with and who they're involved with. You know, check out the information that they're putting out, links back to authors, that there's transparency around the authors and the data and the evidence that they're drawing from to put their advice out, all those sorts of things. Generally speaking, people do have a pretty good radar for when they need to trust something and when they need to trash it. And I think the other important thing to remember here in this conversation, though, is that there is quite a variation in health literacy across the community. We don't all think the same. We don't all take in and act on health information in the same way. And there's some really, you know, just if I can add in, you know, to equip people with information. Often people don't know what they need to know. So if we can equip people with some guidance about the right questions to ask your doctor, that's really helpful. Well, and there's some really good campaigns around, like Choosing Wisely Australia, who have five simple questions that people can use to ask their doctor when they go into a consultation. There's a really good tool on the Health Direct website called Question Builder, which people can use to really tailor a set of questions based on information they put into the tool online, so that they're equipped to make, there's an extra assurance there, I suppose, that they're getting the information from their doctor in the context of a consultation.
Yeah, it's great to have that written down, isn't it?
We're well served by all of those things, yeah.
Yeah. Rod, we talked before about the enterprise of science being this long, slow, collaborative effort of gathering data and building a picture of what's happening. That doesn't play out well on Instagram, does it? The modern media is quite different from that. What role could the media play in getting people comfortable with scientific research and good evidence?
I think one of the big ones, and this is a question that comes up a lot, from the media's perspective, I'd summarise it as make sure you ask the next question. So if an interviewee or a professional or representative of a health body or a science, whatever, is making a claim or a statement about a piece of advice or a finding, don't just say, okay, and move on to the next question. Ask them, you know, how do you know compared to what? Is this faster or slower than it was before? Is this the same position we were in last year or 5 years ago? Ask a few deeper questions that open up the conversation a bit more. Not necessarily combative, just ask, because what I see a lot is pronouncements that are like, this is better, or this is a really good thing, this is an improvement, but then that kind of reporting stops. It doesn't say an improvement on what, or from when, or by how much, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's really about asking the next question. So just going a little bit deeper into what's been going on or how that came about. Because it's true, science can be very slow, and that is by definition the way it can operate. That isn't satisfactory, particularly in time of crisis like we're in now, and that's perfectly reasonable. People want answers. People just want to know what the hell they should do, and that's an absolutely reasonable position to take regardless of your level of understanding of science, your health literacy, et cetera, which is a very important point Leanne brought up. So we need to be sympathetic on the side of the science and the communicators, you know, how people's needs are shifting right now in particular, but we also need to recognize that our role to help that is to go a little deeper. Is it good clickbait? No, but not all media has to be clickbait either. You know, there's a danger of considering all media to be the same, and it obviously isn't. Like the ABC, for example, much, much different to many others.
I'll take
that. Free plug there, just for you.
Yeah, great. Well, and the media loves a case study too, and people are much more willing to take on board a narrative around a health issue than screeds of data that lead to a conclusion. How do you deal with that bias in humans?
See, this is an interesting one. It can be a boon and a bane. So we are very much, and the phrase is banded about, we're hardwired to respond to stories and to involve ourselves with stories. And we all seem to love them. So the upside of that is it can be a very engaging technique, a single case, a story of a human being suffering or their success. The downside of that, of course, is, you know, one case does not necessarily mean anything compared to the rest of the people in the same situation. So I think maybe you can kind of, you can attempt to harness them for, you know, good instead of evil. So if you do choose to tell stories or a single narrative, make sure as best it can, it would represent the position of the science, the technology, the healing process, et cetera, that we can represent right now. So you can use the storytelling tool to represent a whole bunch of, you know, solid evidence of the situation with the evidence as it is at the time. But it's very easy to digress and just start to tell personal stories, and people are immediately swept away. It's just the way we are. Very seductive to do as the storyteller as well.
And I think we've all been armed with some useful questions this morning to get around our inherent biases. Thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary. Cheers.
Leanne Wells, CEO of the Consumers Health Forum, and Rod Lamberts, Deputy Director of the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science. That's at the ANU. And if you want links to those websites that Leanne mentioned, they're going to be up on the Life Matters page a little bit later this morning. I'm Hilary Harper. You're listening to Life Matters. Michael McKenzie, what are our listeners saying about this?
Lots of responses here, Hilary. Let's go through some of the texts. I am a clinician, writes this texter. I will not go into the medical education deficiency. And yet I sense that's what they're talking about. Sue in Mwilumbah says, doctors' default treatment cure is generally drugs. Food and good nutrition is rarely offered as advice, yet even the ancients, Sue says, knew food is our medicine. Regarding COVID, why no emphasis on maintaining strong immune systems through diet and lifestyle? This gives me reason for some doubts and looking further afield for good advice. Another texter says, where do you go when your health issue has not been fixed, despite specialists seeing you? And another texter says, people do have trouble weeding out the BS. Chaz in Melbourne says, obviously you guys don't listen to your own programs. Professor Ramesh Thakur shows why we shouldn't trust our media, government or medical professions. Where are our investigative journalists? And if we have time later on, Hilary, I'll mention some of the reactions to UFOs and swearing in front of our children from yesterday's show too.
Thank you very much, Michael. And a text, someone has texted in saying we should clarify the difference between the word research, people doing their own research online, and merely searching for information, because the word research has connotations of science, and looking online for information is not the same thing. Thanks for that text. You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National.